Okay, folks, this is Elwin Shamroth here again. Once again, welcome to our bi-weekly teleseminars. We just finished a very successful course in LA, and we're going to be doing another one starting today, 1 week in Baltimore. That'll be our last live interactive in-person course for the year. But that's not what we're all about now. We're doing a teleseminar. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, the way this works, we've got today three people who have submitted a question relating to, it's typically relating to something on the case list. And what we really go through is find out those issues that generate general principles that are relevant for everyone. So you'll all learn the basics of how to defend various issues that you're likely to face in the exam. Again, this is unrehearsed. I did receive the three brief stories via email of what's going to be presented today. But more than that, I don't know where the conversation will go. As I said, it's totally unrehearsed. So let's just see if our candidates are with us. And you'll notice I will not mention last names throughout. We don't want to embarrass anyone in case I ask a question which they don't know the answer to, and I don't want to embarrass anyone in front of their colleagues. So everyone always remains anonymous. With that out the way, Ruth, are you there? Ruth, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much for joining, and welcome to you. Our next candidate has requested to remain anonymous, so I'm not going to call out for anonymous. I'll just present his or her issue, because it is relevant for everyone. And then the third person is Patricia. Patricia, are you there? Are you with us?
Yes.
And thank you once again to you as well. And welcome. Ruth, let's start with you. You sent the two cases on your list, but you didn't give all the information. So I'm a little compromised in terms of my understanding of the case, and that's okay. But I would like you to take the first case and present it to us as succinctly as you can, and then we'll discuss what your concerns might be. So go ahead.
Thank you. So the first case is a 44-year-old G7P3 who came to me for amenorrhea. She had not had a period in approximately 9 months and was also complaining of vasomotor symptoms. She was, concerned about whether she might be in menopause or if there was maybe something else pathological that was causing her lack of periods.
So why did you bring this case up as an issue of concern? Because thus far, you've really presented a case of a person who's more than anything else likely to be going through menopause. What is there any concern that perhaps I'm missing here?
No, there's not a specific concern per se that I have. I'm having trouble defending the case. It's just that this is not one of my strong points, and I just was hoping to get some practice talking through these cases.
Okay. So it's for everyone listening in, this is not an issue of having to defend something that's on your case, but rather a question of how to respond to various questions which may come your way.
Correct.
This is relevant to everyone listening in. It is a favorite question in any OBGYN oral board exam, and that is, quite simply, how do you work up secondary amenorrhea? What's your first line of labs? What might your second and rarely even third line of labs be? And whenever you get, this is the important part that I wanted to extract from this case. Whenever you get into a discussion like this, you've got to justify why you're doing whichever labs first, and then second, and then third. And obviously, the second and third are dependent on what the first and second results are like.
Right.
Cost considerations and difficulty considerations also come into play. So people can't see this, but in your email to me, you wrote that you did an FSH, an estradiol, a TSH,
mm-hmm.
and a prolactin.
Yeah.
Now, this is pretty standard, but I want to share with you, and this, when I'm talking to you, Ruth, I'm really talking to everyone listening in.
Yeah.
I've reviewed literally hundreds of cases over the years, and virtually every single one of you have written down the actual labs that you did. I prefer you folks to be a little bit more vague and write amenorrhea lab workup, because that invites the question, what is your lab workup? And then you can say it and start impressing your examiner instead of just reading it. But we're beyond that point. Your cases are submitted.
Right.
So you folks have put down, by and large, the lab that you actually did. And you appropriately included a prolactin level. At any time you've got the word prolactin on a case list,
mm-hmm.
understand the examiner can take that and run with it.
Okay.
And you opened yourself up to a conversation potentially on hyperprolactinemia. And with this in mind, I just want to share a few things that all of you need to be comfortable to speak about. Number one, how would you counsel a patient regarding having a serum prolactin level drawn? And if I were to ask you that question, Ruth, how would you respond?
When I have a patient in whom I'm ordering a prolactin, I let them know to complete it first thing in the morning, fasting. I tell them not to exercise or have intercourse or any sexual activity for 3 days prior to drawing the prolactin.
You've mentioned all the things that I wanted to hear. So this is great. Okay. So you did well there. What's the normal? The upper limit of normal for a prolactin level?
I think it varies a little bit by lab, but
yes.
Somewhere around 20, 25.
Perfect. And and here's a tough one. What are the units of prolactin?
Nanograms per milliliter.
Excellent. Very good. Nanograms per ml. Very good. What are the options of treatment for hyperprolactinemia?
Options for treatment include cobergoline and bromocriptine.
Perfect. Good enough. Let me see. Is there anything else I want to ask you on that? No. Those are the big questions. Okay. Now, This is a little specific to you, Ruth, but the issue is relevant to everyone. Let me just share with everyone listening in. Ruth, as part of this perimenopausal patient workup, rule out menopause, it probably was your working diagnosis.
Right.
You did both an FSH and an estradiol, correct?
Yeah.
Why? Why did you do both? And to everyone listening in, Guarus, and thinking about this, I don't mind potentially you folks doing both, but you've got to be able to justify it and give a reason, because otherwise they can, number one, kind of hypothetically accuse you of overutilization of resources, and number two, it leaves the examiner with a maybe conscious, at least some subconscious consideration that you're not exactly sure, and so you're just ordering more tests just to cover your bases, and it suggests an element of imprecision. So, Ruth, again, the question is, why did you do both an FSH and an estradiol?
The estradiol, if it's low, lets me know that the patient is not producing as much estrogen, and the high FSH indicates that this is has affected the feedback loop from the hypothalamus, so this isn't just today, this is not just a, you know, because of where they are in their cycle.
Wouldn't you have been able to gather almost as much information by just doing an FSH? And only if the FSH were premenopausal in nature, might you then want to consider doing an estrogen? My question is, why not just do the FSH on its own? Don't you think, and look, I've got to tell everyone listening in, I'm a generalist, I'm not an REI,
right.
But to my thinking, an FSH in this clinical setting would have been sufficient. What, feel free to argue with me, Ruth. I mean that. Don't be shy.
No, I know. I guess I'm not sure what my answer is.
Okay, so this is where I wanted to go with this case. You folks may find on your cases that you've got something similar to what I've just shared with you regarding Ruth's case. And the best way to get around it is in the exam to say something very, very similar to what I'm going to suggest right now. I would say, you know, in preparing for my exam, I've realized to do both an FSH and an estradiol up front is somewhat redundant. And in fact, I've changed the way I practice. And for the last 6 months or 12 months, I now do, in this case, just an FSH. And if that's elevated, I've got my diagnosis. If it's normal or low, then I'm going to do further testing with an estradiol and other more sophisticated tests. But I be comfortable in a thing like this to say, you know, I would do it a little differently. You haven't killed the patient by ordering both an estradiol and an FSH. And you show the examiner, which is a very comforting notion for the examiner, that you're not dogmatic, you're not egocentric, that you know it better than everyone else. If you see something where you can change and improve, you're willing to change. And you're working on your candidate examiner relationship. So that's how I would recommend you handle that issue. Would you be comfortable with that, Ruth?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, sure. The rest of the discussion is a discussion on hormone replacement therapy, and that's pretty straightforward. I'm not going to go to that. I think we've covered all the main issues on this case. Is there anything I haven't addressed on this particular case, Ruth?
No. The next case is my other amenorrhea case. Is a younger patient.
Okay. But before we start that, I want to do anonymous's case,
and then
Patricia's case, and then we're going to come back to you, okay? Just to make sure that everyone gets their turn. So I'm just going to read out to you I don't know who the person is who presented this, but I'm just going to read you what he or she wrote. And it goes as follows. How would you suggest handling the issue of administering Rogam for induced or spontaneous abortion at less than 12 weeks for Rh negative patient? Based on recommendations from the WHO, it didn't print up the edge of the page, but from the WHO, RCO, and SFP, the practice at our institution is to engage in shared decision-making with patients regarding Rogam, less than 12 weeks. So we often do not give it. ACOG still recommends Rogam at all gestational ages for induced or spontaneous abortion, however. So the issue here is, and a fair number of you listening in have this issue on your cases and in your practice. You're not necessarily doing things exactly the way the nationwide standard of care dictates or what ACOG dictates. It might be due to a hospital policy. It may be due to a practice policy, an HMO policy. It may be because of a statewide policy. And here I'm referring to things like how one manages abortion, for example. And in the exam, you won't get into the politics of that. That's a separate issue. But you, in essence, in a case here, in a situation where you're doing things differently from what the examiner expects you to say. And if you just go ahead and say, well, that's the practice policy or that's the hospital policy, if you stop there, the next question is going to be, fine, I understand that's the practice policy. What do you think about that policy? You can't just say that's the policy and that's the end of the question. You've got to be able to either defend the policy or give your opinion of the policy. So in a case like whoever submitted this case, he or she is aware that what they're doing is not recommended by ACOG, classically. And just for those of you listening in, typically if it's an ectopic pregnancy or first trimester miscarriage, it's mini dose, which is 50, I think it's micrograms, or it might be milligrams, but I think it's micrograms. And if it's a second or third trimester, it's 300 micrograms, okay? So it's mini dose is 50 or 300. You can say, you know, there are pros and cons to giving it versus not giving it. The argument in favor of giving it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The argument against giving it is ABC. This is how I counsel my patients. And by the way, you always try and show you're promoting the ACOG position. So you say, when I counsel them, I always counsel them in favor of receiving it. But if they are adamant they don't want it, as long as they are aware of the risks and benefits, I will, in an issue such as this of Rogam, I will oblige the patient. And so if you've got a case like that where you know you're doing something which is not classical standard of care, the defense ultimately will come down to how did you counsel the patient? And I know from experience a number of you have this kind of thing on your cases. So be comfortable to prepare a defense along those lines. It comes down to counseling. What are the pros and cons of doing one option versus another? Okay, that's the only point I wanted to make on that case regarding Rogam sent in by Anonymous. Let's move on. Patricia, can you present your case and we'll discuss it?
Sure. So my patient is a 30-year-old G2P1. She, in terms of antepartum diagnosis, she is a previous C-section times 1. Her G1 was for fetal intolerance. And then she also has von Willebrand disease. She's unsure of what type, but it sounds like she was followed by a previous provider, and her von Willebrand factor and her factor VIII factors have been checked throughout pregnancy, and they were fine. She presented at 40 weeks and one day to the hospital for decreased fetal movement and a strong desire to toelect. So I admitted her. Her cervix, she had a very good Bechet's core and was very favorable, so I just induced her with Pitocin. Long story short, and I guess I will defend this in a second, I ended up having to do a vacuum-assisted vaginal delivery, which I know is a contraindication with von Willebrand disease. So.
Okay, so the question I have to ask you, I'm going to come back with a few additional questions, but the
sure.
obvious question, you acknowledge there's a, and I'm going to be honest, I'm not MFM, I don't know if it's, is it absolute or relative contraindication, do you know, because I don't.
I don't know off the top of my head if it's an absolute, I definitely know it's at least a relative, so.
Yeah, I would guess it's relative, but I could be wrong. This obviously is a question that you must know the answer to. The rest of you, it's nice if you know it, but Patricia must know it because she's got a case like this on her list. That's point number one. Point number two, briefly tell us, why did you go, even though you knew this was at least a relative contraindication, why did you nevertheless proceed to vacuum?
Sure. So she progressed very quickly during labor, and by the time I was called in the room, she was already pushing. And then when I looked at the fetal strip in the room, there were some variables, and it was like a persistent category 2 tracing, but with explosive effort, she had actually brought that fetal head down to like +4, almost like +5 station, like the fetal head was at the perineum, and she had strongly mentioned that she wanted to toelect, especially since she was so close to delivering. And then I pushed with her a couple more times, and again, she had good explosive efforts, but just wasn't able to get like past the perineum. I did discuss with her, since the fetal tracing, again, was persistently category 2, I was concerned that it was going to turn into a category 3 as the fetal heart rate was like dropping into like the 80s persistently. So I did counsel her. I was like, you have von Willebrand. I would suggest a C-section, but she's like, can you do anything? I'm so close. And so after I counseled her, and again, the fetal head was at like +5 station. I did end up putting the vacuum on, and I just did one pull just to bring the head out. And then I immediately disengaged it. And then she had a vaginal delivery.
Okay, fine. Couple of questions. Is, and I haven't posed the question to you yet, but isn't forceps also contraindicated in von Willebrand's?
It is not. I do not know how to do them, and I was by myself.
So that was my next question. So just by the way, 90% of you listening in are thinking, oh my goodness, what am I going to say if this is my case, if they present me with a clinical case like this? The point that I want all of you to be aware is that 90% plus of you are doing vacuums. 95% of you are doing vacuums. If 10% of you are doing forceps, it's a lot. And some of you, 5%, are doing both. So if you're only doing vacuum, don't feel bad. You're in the vast, vast majority. Now, as a general principle, this is similar to the first case that was presented by Ruth. Whenever you do something which seems to potentially breach standard of care, the defense is invariably counseling. Comes down to how did you counsel it? And exactly as I said to Ruth, pertains here. As long as you counsel her on the risks and benefits, you know, you'd rather not do it. I would rather recommend a C-section, but at the same time, the patient refused. I wouldn't say that she said, please push, let us try some further. I would be a little bit stronger and say she really was adamant about not having a C-section. It makes it easier to defend, okay? That's just an FYI. But whenever you seemingly are breaching standard of care, and this is very subtle, okay, it's a counseling defense that's going to save the day for you, and you should be totally comfortable to discuss that. How did you counsel? A few other questions. By the way, von Willebrand, for all of you listening in, typically is in about found in about 20-25% of case lists in the office section for teenagers who present with abnormal uterine bleeding. So just be aware that's when most of you have von Willebrand's. And if you've got von Willebrand on your case list, the question you have to know is what is the mode of inheritance? What's the difference between, and I'm digging up deep in my brain here from medical school days, what's the difference, and maybe, Patricia, you can help me out. What's the difference between von Willebrand and Christmas disease? And, yeah, Christmas disease. Do you know? I think they're somewhat similar, but I can't remember. Do you know?
I did not, but I will look that up.
Yeah, just look, if any of you have got von Willebrand's disease, just be able to literally say one sentence on Christmas disease, okay? And also, I believe you can be a carrier as well as have the disease. Is that correct, Patricia?
Yes.
So if you've got a case like this, and I'm guessing this is the case, I might be wrong, was this particular patient a carrier or affected?
I don't know. I inherited this patient from, she moved like halfway through the pregnancy, so I didn't have
okay.
all of her.
So that's very important to mention in your presentation.
Okay.
Because these kind of conversations should take place during 9 months of antepartum visits, not intrapartum. So you should mention, I saw her for the first time in labor. Had I seen her in the office, these are conversations I would have had with her before she went into labor. But you might want to say, based on her history, in which she had no history of heavy periods, bleeding disorder, tendency to be excessive bleeding, I do think she probably was a carrier. Just make it easier for yourself, okay?
She did mention to me that during her first pregnancy she had no bleeding issues or complications.
Okay, so they say in her first pregnancy she didn't bleed excessively. On a gynecological basis, she didn't bleed excessively. There was no history of AUB. Build up your case to say that if she had von Willebrand, it was mild, and she was probably a carrier. And so it gave me greater leeway and a greater comfort level that even though I counseled her against it, I felt it wasn't unreasonable to go with it. You understand? Bill, make your case is what I'm saying, okay? And there was one other thing I wanted to mention. Carrier, yes. That, folks, this would be with any hereditary condition. They may ask you, if they classically ask this with an autosomal recessive presentation, and if the mother is basically healthy or else known to be a carrier, because they only really experience symptoms if they have the disease, but if she's a carrier and the father of the baby is unknown, what is the probability that the baby will have the disease? And I believe it's 1 in 4. Let's say she has a 50% chance, 1 in 2 of donating the gene, times the father, if his status is unknown, one's assuming he's healthy, so he's a carrier, so his chance of donating the affected gene is 1 in 2, and times the incidence of the gene in the population. These things are typically of the order 1 in 10. So I'm guessing it's 1 over 10 divided by a half, multiplied by a half, it's 1 in 4, 1 in 40, I'm guessing. But they can ask you to work that out for them, for any of you who actually have one of these things on your case list. So are you comfortable with that, Patricia?
Yes.
And there's one other thing. That last question that I just asked comes into the counseling as well, because it's nice to be able to say, I could be wrong. I'm doing this off the top of my head. If there's a 1 in 40 chance of the baby being affected, that's a 2.5% chance, which means there's a 97.5% chance that the baby's not affected. And if, at worst, the baby is a carrier, it's a mild disease, and that also mitigated your thinking in terms of not insisting on the C-section. You see what I'm doing is I'm just building your case, your defense,
sure,
for moving forward. And folks, for all of you going who have a case, a situation like this, it won't necessarily be von Willebrand's, but just build up your case for reasons why you felt you were comfortable to take the path of action that you took. Now, just for the sake of completeness, because a small but significant number of you will be confronted with a question which is basically, in essence, similar to what I'm going to present to Patricia now. Patricia, I'm going to change the case slightly. The patient turns around to you and says, I don't want a C-section under any circumstances, okay? And
mm-hmm.
you counsel her along the lines that you've done, and as you're counseling her, you notice that the fetus develops a terminal bradycardia. What are you going to do?
I feel like I would counsel the patient again with, I guess very quickly, since it is a terminal bradycardia, that without a C-section, there is a good chance that your fetus is not going to do well or potentially die.
And she still says, I do not want a C-section. Are you going to stand there and watch the fetal heart rate go to zero and do nothing?
Well,
hey? Are you going to do that?
I mean, I guess.
It's a simple question.
I guess
question.
I have to.
Yes or no? Are you going to watch? Are you going to watch this baby die in front of your eyes, basically?
Oh man, I don't want to, but I guess you have to.
No, that's not the question. Are you going to stand by and watch this baby die in front of your eyes? You don't have this much time in the exam. You've got to come up with an answer. What are you going to do? It's not an unrealistic question. And just by the way, I had this exact situation in clinical practice. Okay? So this happens, this kind of crap. But go ahead. What are you going to do in the exam? It can happen.
I mean, if it was the same situation that I was in, I would offer. If
she says,
if
"Don't come near me with a blade. I'm not interested in a C-section. Don't touch me for a C-section." Are you going to watch this baby die?
I mean, if the patient is outright refusing a C-section, then.
You can do a vacuum. She says, I don't want a C-section, and I don't want a vacuum. Don't touch me. I'll do this. I'll push it out myself. Don't touch me.
I would have
Are you
going to
watch this baby die?
Then.
So you're going to let the baby die? That's what you're saying.
I mean, if she has been counseled appropriately and she is refusing.
We spent 3 minutes on this, and you're refusing to answer the question directly. Are you going to let this baby die? Yes or no?
I mean, yes. If the patient is refusing, then yes.
That's the right answer. And I purposely pushed you. And for everyone listening in, they will all think, gee, I'm pleased I'm not facing that question. But for the purposes of the exam, and Patricia, you were going down that road, which was correct. For the purposes of the exam, you say, you know, I would make sure I've counseled her thoroughly. She, as best as possible, she understands all the issues. You can say, I would convene an emergency meeting of the ethics committee in the hospital, knowing full well that this situation is going to sort itself out before such a sitting can occur. But if the patient insisted that I do not do a C-section or a vacuum, I have no choice but to respect her wishes, and I'm not allowed to touch her. To do so would be equivalent to taking a knife to her tummy. It's assault. So, you know, I gave it to you. It classically is in the OB scenario, but I'm pleased this came up, because I'm pleased every one of you heard this. Because if you're confronted with that situation, you know how to handle it. It's a tragic situation. I feel badly. As long as I've counseled her, I'll respect the patient's wishes. I cannot do this. And the baby may well die. And that's the way you handle it, okay? So I'm pleased that we went through that. And I think that's... Those are all the issues that I want to go through. Patricia, is there anything else that I haven't mentioned that you want to, that you're not sure about?
I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay, very good. That was a great case. I'm pleased you had it. All right, Ruth, we're going to come back to you. You've got a second case. Go ahead and present the case. Let's hear it. Ruth, are you there?
Yeah, sorry. Just trying to flip back to the right page here.
Okay.
So this one is also amenorrhea. 27-year-old, or I'm sorry.
Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah.
I know historically that virtually in every single one of you who are listening in by now have attended or will have attended our Definitive Board Prep course. And I just want to, for the handful who may not have, if you get into a conversation on amenorrhea, just do your utmost to make sure it's a discussion on secondary amenorrhea, not primary amenorrhea, because you don't want to go down that road. It's a horrible, dark hole that you won't extract yourself out of in a very pleasant way. It's a tough differential. It's not a nice conversation. So just you say, well, assuming this is a case of secondary amenorrhea, I would do ABC. But don't ask the examiner, do you mean primary or secondary? Because they'll give you the primary and you've just made it a lot harder for yourself. So sorry, Ruth, I just wanted to get that out. Go ahead and present your case.
So this is a patient that presented with secondary amenorrhea. She is a 28-year-old G0, P0, who had previously had irregular menses for some time and then stopped having periods altogether for approximately a year prior to seeing me.
Okay. And you want to know what kind of questions they can ask you? Is that what you're going with?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a classical case for the workup of secondary amenorrhea. And just for the sake of everyone listening in, the test that Ruth did order was a urine pregnancy test, a serum TSH, prolactin. There it is again, FSH and estradiol. Okay, same issue as we mentioned before. DHEAS and 17-hydroxyprogesterone and testosterone. And I can't really argue too much with that choice of labs. It's pretty reasonable. When you're dealing with a case of amenorrhea, the way I think about it is the classical, it's the way Speroff describes it in his book, four compartments. The first is hypothalamic, then pituitary. Number three is ovarian. And number four is outflow tract. And you just go about ruling out each of those compartments in a ordered fashion. And the only other thing I would add to what we mentioned earlier, don't forget your premature ovarian failure as an option. And probably about 25-30% of you have in your office section a case of premature ovarian failure. Even if you don't have it on your case list, they can give it to you as a structured case. And I just want you folks to be aware that in a small but significant percentage of cases, premature ovarian failure is part of a multiple endocrinopathy. And so if you've got a case of premature ovarian failure, obviously you do a karyotype, for example, looking for Turner's and streak ovaries, Turner's. And you also, what else do you have to do? You've got to do tests like tests for diabetes, because they may have antibodies to islet cells, anti-smooth muscle, anti-lupus cells, complement, anti-DNA antibodies. You've got to look for all these antibodies as part of an autoimmune disease. So most of you have not done this if you've got such a case on your list. That's okay. I just want you to be able to mention that you, in preparing for the exam, you've read up and noticed that this can be the case. In fact, this patient has since been called back. We're in the process of working her up further. You can just introduce that little aspect. But the only additional comments I will make here is make sure the conversation doesn't go down the primary amenorrhea road, and you all heard Ruth very quickly, very nicely correct herself after I shared that with her. And there's just one other thing that Ruth wrote in the email to me, but I don't think she mentioned it. You wrote here, Ruth, that you did a pelvic ultrasound, which I'm assuming was normal. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only point I'm making here, if you were looking, for example, for the PCOS, and you know you've done androgen blood work here, and in the face of amenorrhea, it seems like it's a real differential that you need to consider. So if it's PCOS, yeah, you want to see the classical string of pearls sign.
Right.
But outside of that, I want to caution all of you listening in. If you have a thin patient, or just not an obese patient, and in whom you can get a decent pelvic exam, in that situation, if you've gone ahead and ordered an ultrasound, the question might be, why did you do that? Was it necessary? Again, is it an overutilization of resources? Because if you've got a good exam, you can A, feel, is the uterus normal in size? Is it bulky and soft, spongy, suggestive of adenomyosis? Does it have firm knobs all over it, suggestive of fibroids? And are there any adnexal masses? So if you get a good pelvic exam, the question becomes then, why did you do the ultrasound? And I'm just going to so that's the most important point. You don't want to be accused of overutilization of resources. I mean, it's not a strong accusation, but you want things to really go well. So if you feel you've got that situation or that potential conversation coming up in your exam, the easiest way just to get out of it is to say, you know, the exam was a reasonable exam, but I felt compromised because she had a little bit more adipose tissue on the anterior-abdominal wall than I would have liked. So my examination was a little compromised. They can't argue with you on that. If you say my exam was compromised, that's it. They can't argue, and you can justify doing that ultrasound. Okay? So, Ruth, are you okay with this case and the things that I've mentioned?
I ended up doing a progesterone challenge test, and she had withdrawal bleeding. And then she ended up, after that, just having her regular periods came back. And I don't really know how to explain it.
I'm pleased you brought this up, because this is relevant to everyone. Each of us have different clinical scenarios and cases where we go back on it and we say, I can't explain this. Why did this happen? And you know, it might be that you reset her clock, so to speak, with the progesterone challenge. And you can say, you know, maybe the progesterone challenge was not only diagnostic, but somewhat therapeutic. And you say in the exam, but at the end of the day, I've got to be honest, I don't know why she spontaneously started menstruating again. I mean, there were other things I could have done, but in the absence, I'm not sure exactly what caused her to menstruate again. I don't think I'll ever know. And it's okay to say that. You don't have to be shy. We don't know everything. We can't explain everything. Okay? So that's how I would handle that situation for you and for everyone else listening in. A fair number of you have that kind of issue, not the specific issue, but that kind of issue on your list. Ruth, anything else that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, so what are the chances that, even though my two patients are secondary amenorrhea, that they would twist it into a primary? Yeah.
Okay. Look, I can't give any candidate a guarantee, but I would just say this much: it's very unlikely, very unlikely. The people who are likely to get the primary amenorrhea conversation are those people who actually wrote on their case list primary amenorrhea. If you are one of those who actually wrote primary amenorrhea on your case list, then yes, you've got to be able to give a conversation on delayed puberty, normal pubertal development, the differential diagnosis of a blind ending vaginal pouch. You know, this is not stuff that we enjoy getting into as generalists. So I can't give a guarantee. I don't expect it. If you've got it on your cases, then yes, it's fair game. You need to know it. And the bar is a little higher. Because at the end of the day, you manage the patient. You need to be able to say what you did. You need to know what needs to be done because you had the case. If you just have a case of secondary amenorrhea, the bar, I have to believe, is substantially lower for a primary amenorrhea conversation than it is for a secondary. Secondary amenorrhea, it's totally legitimate, fair game. It's pretty much bread and butter, OBGYN. So you've got to know that. I wouldn't have sleepless nights about primary amenorrhea But I just want you to be aware. I don't want any of you in the exam when they say, how would you work up a 17-year-old with amenorrhea? I don't want any of you to turn around to the examiner and ask them, are you referring to a 17-year-old with primary or secondary amenorrhea? That's like shooting yourself in the head. You don't want to go down that road. They'll invariably give you the harder of the two options. So just don't do that to yourself, okay? So that's as best as I can share with you, Ruth.
Yeah, thanks so much. That's
comforting to some extent.
Yeah.
Well, any other questions on your end, Ruth? Because we're almost out of time. We need to close this up. Anything else quickly on your end?
No, thank you so much.
Okay. Sure, you're welcome. So listen, to all of you, firstly, thank you for joining. I know the exam is coming up on us very quickly. I do feel very strongly that if any of you find issues on your case list and you're not sure how to defend, you think you may have written it up badly, you may have made a mistake, either in terms of how you've written it down or in terms maybe even of how you managed it, and you're not sure, please, I feel very strongly, I don't want any of you walking into the exam knowing that you've got a case and you don't know how to defend it. If you've got such a situation, please be in touch with the office. We've still got another session in September before we start the first week of the October exam. So, you know, get in touch with us, and I'd be happy to discuss the case. It's really important. There's no need. I'm happy to do this as a freebie. It's part of what we do. But I don't want you folks going into the exam with the knowledge that you've got a case you don't know how to handle. That's unforgivable. Okay, so folks, let me share with you again, if you are still considering attending a course, we've got one more live course. The rest after next week, the only courses that will be available will be online, pre-recorded. And there certainly is an advantage, if you can get away at this late stage, there is an advantage to coming to a live in-person course. And like I said, it will be in Baltimore starting today, next week Sunday. And we'd love to see you folks there. That being said, our next teleseminar is going to be in 2 weeks' time on the 22nd of September. I've got one more last request, please, if I can. Can I ask all of you, it'll take 15 seconds, please right now go to your email, type in the address info@examprow.com. Just rate the teleseminar. 1 out of 5 is lousy, 5 out of 5 is excellent. If you want to add any further comments, I'd be happy. I really would appreciate it. We take the comments very seriously. We take the scores very seriously. Please, 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 just do it right now. It'll take 15 seconds and it'll be done. It'll help us tremendously and it helps us to help candidates. So again, if you rate this teleseminar on a score of 5, 1 is lousy, 5 is fantastic. And we'd appreciate that very much. So the next teleseminar will be the 22nd of September. To Ruth and Patricia, thank you so much. And to the rest of you also, thank you for joining, and I look forward to doing this again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, folks. This then concludes our teleseminar. All the best. Bye-bye.